Oh my God, where's our data going? What's the processing? What's the privacy issues? Who's housing it? We don't want this data to get into the wrong hands. We're in a state of caution right now.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It is important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to ensure you don't miss any of the featured episodes. You can also join us online at thebusinessofaiinhealthcare.com. Today's episode of The Business of AI in Healthcare takes us to Phoenix to meet up with Dr. Ahmed Abizadegan. Ahmed is a double board certified clinical informatics physician with Stanson Health, who currently teaches informatics to physician executive through the Alliance for Physician Leadership at the University of Texas, Dallas. Welcome to the podcast, Ahmed.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Ahmed, I've experienced you in the classroom for consecutive days of learning, and we always run out of time. So we'll be challenged today to cover some interesting topics within our, so to speak, 30-minute window. Let's start with informatics and work our way into AI. We've got a pretty diverse audience of learners, so tell us how you got into informatics and why it's so important and foundational to healthcare.
Absolutely. So I'll start off by kind of telling you how I look and see what informatics is. So informatics is the X of information, the science of information, and how you use data and information to help you make decisions. So you use informatics in every day of your life. It might not be as obvious, but data and data analysis is used frequently for maps, for example. So if you put an address in your map on your phone, it gives you a computation of data that tells you how long it will take to get to your destination and multiple different options and routes. So you, in the end of the day, make the decision of which route to take. So really, informatics is about decision support, giving and computating information to help you make better decisions. Of course, that could be applied to healthcare. It could be applied to banking. It's used to make predictions with elections and so on and so forth. As far as my own self and journey, when I finished internal medicine residency, that was back in 2012, and I decided to pursue a chief residency in quality and patient safety. This was a program that was really sponsored through the Veterans Affairs National Center for Patient Safety. And I honestly didn't know exactly what it was, but I knew that it was something big and something huge would come out of it, and it was the path less traveled. So I did a year of quality and patient safety on the hospital health system side, and I always found myself down in the basement, as I would call it, where the clinical informatics department was, which was really the custodians and leadership of the electronic health record system. So we were always making adjustments and looking at data that was coming out and inputted into the EHR. And after that year, or close to the end of that year, I presented some work we did nationally, which got noticed by hospital leadership. And they offered me this position that was head of or chief of informatics. And again, I didn't quite know what that was. And the position was vacant for 2 years, but I said, hey, if nobody else wants it, I definitely want it. And so fast forward, here we are 10 years later. So
unbelievable. That's an incredible story. So you're an opportunist, to say the least. You saw something that looked significant. You knew there was value in what you were doing because you're already tweaking with data a lot, but you really didn't have a clue that it was going to be that significant going forward. So what moved it forward at such a fast pace?
Yeah. Once I started into the position, so this is 2013, about 6 months later, there was an official board certification pathway for physicians. So both the American College of Pathology and the American Board of Preventive Medicine co-sponsored this board. So just as if you finished training in medicine and you wanted to do cardiology or GI, now you could do this thing that was called clinical informatics. And prior to that point, anyone that really was in informatics that I knew, they kind of fell into it because they were seen as the tech doc, or they were a super user of the electronic health record system. But this was a big significant point in 2013 that formalized this into its own specialty. Fast forward a couple years later, 2015, affiliations with the University of Arizona College of Medicine Phoenix, our program was the fifth fellowship training program in clinical informatics within the country. And we were really in that second cohort. And I eventually became program director for a number of years, leading training for physicians in informatics. So it's really cool because imagine that you were there at the onset of a field like cardiology, which now is mainstream. You say cardiology, everybody knows that's the heart doc. So I was there at the inception, essentially at the inception of informatics as a formal specialty. And I always joke around that all the founding fathers are pretty much still alive. Everyone's kicking and doing it well. And we're all kind of moving this boat in the direction of technology and artificial intelligence and how we can optimize healthcare delivery and use data and information to better healthcare.
Did you feel like you had to give up any of your clinical expertise being a real doctor because you started leaning into the informatics data side of things?
Yeah. This is such a good question, and it's one that always comes up. The truth is, the God's honest truth is, till this day, I have never been 0% clinical. I have always done some clinical. And when I was the informatics chief, I did about 1 week every four, six. Sometimes I would stretch a little bit more, but I never didn't do it. So as the years progressed over time, I naturally have experienced. Of course, I haven't seen as many patients as certain docs that see patients every day, but I'm always in the loop on operations, processes. And when I finally jumped from the health system side and got into technology and software with Stanson Health, one of the big components with the job was that I really want to continue and maintain clinical skill. So I still do about one weekend a month as a hospitalist, and my a boss and company have been very supportive. It helps with my street credibility. And then when I'm talking to people about AI and software and technology and healthcare, they know that I know because I was just on the front lines last weekend, for example.
So I would think, and I'm probably wrong in this thought process, but I would think that once you start to go down this deep path of technology, data, informatics, things of that nature, that you become the super nerd and you start programming and writing code. Yeah. And is that a false belief, or is that what happens? Yeah.
I would say overwhelming majority of physicians in informatics are not coders, are not technical. And when I was the program director of our fellowship, I always told the fellows that you certainly can learn coding, and we set up the opportunity for them to get that education. And those physicians that have those technical skills, to me, they just speak a better language with programmers and coders. But most of us are truly more on the strategy side. So there's a great deal of individuals that have that skill set to code. Our knowledge base is still clinical first. So you're bringing me in because I bring that clinical knowledge domain, and then I bring that technology knowledge domain. So most, including myself, I will admit that I am not a technical coder. Some of my colleagues are, but most are not.
But you can relate to them. That's the main thing.
Yes, I can relate. And the truth is, I do have some foundational knowledge. And in fact, some of that is tested on the boards at a very basic level. So I have understanding of differences when you write code, like between the word and versus or. Of course, that's extraordinarily basic. But yes, I can speak to programmers. I can tell them what is needed. And then I know what their capabilities are as well. So I have a definite understanding. I'm just not going to be the one that writes the code.
Well, you know, that's pretty much the theme that we've experienced in our executive education in working with physicians, is that when we introduce them to a financial course, we're not trying to make them a chief financial officer. We're just trying to make them feel comfortable sitting in a financial discussion. And the same with a lot of different areas. We want to make people feel comfortable. And I think being in the informatics area, you have to be able to make people feel comfortable about what you're trying to accomplish without getting in the way of all the technology at the same time.
Absolutely.
So I think that's a very special skill. You know, when I think of informatics, and I think about how important it is, there's so many touch points. I would think It helps reduce costs. I think that would be true. Does informatics actually help make things more efficient? And cost in healthcare is so outrageous right now. Is that an element of reducing cost?
Yes, absolutely. There are so many examples. This could be a 5-hour conversation by itself in terms of how informatics helps. I think now that I'm on the software side and I see health systems across the country, the difference between health systems is their ability to implement technology and really take on the task of governing optimization and doing the optimization work. So in terms of being efficient, look, you're going to input an address in a map and you're probably going to take the quickest route. You used information. There's an accident on route X, so you're going to take route Y, and that's going to make you more efficient because you're going to get to your destination quicker. So in healthcare, there are so many examples of how we can use data to optimize things. Often we think of it, the use cases with people that need something before other people. So for example, you've been smoking for 20 years, you don't have lung cancer, but if I've only been smoking 5 years, we should probably put you at the front of the line and get you screened first. Because then if we find something, we can take action quicker. So that type of optimization is truly a forever event. In fact, one of my colleagues that's well known said that to me early in my career, that optimization is a forever event. Never going to stop. You always can get better, more efficient. You think of cars that are faster, more safe. Their quality is better. There's just a whole plethora of things that compare cars to the 80s and 90s versus today. I mean, even base model brands that are not luxury are actually very well-built cars. So we kind of have grown accustomed to that in certain fields of life and certain things we consume. But in healthcare, once again, we're a little bit behind, but that has been changing for the past decade or so. We're really making a push of effort to make things more efficient, optimize, get the right patient to the right doc at the right time. Get the highest risk patient in early, the person who can wait, let them wait. Now, of course, in a me first type society, sometimes people don't like that, but still, if things are not necessary, trust the process, trust the guidelines, trust that your doc will take care of you when it's your time and when it's your turn.
So if informatics provides this foundational data infrastructure and process that really helps do a better job in healthcare delivery, informatics is doing that, then AI, they ought to be able to leverage this data and generate deeper insights, even improve the decision-making, maybe even make operational efficiency better. So I think there's a combination. It's kind of like maybe the peanut butter and jelly. Together, they really play a pivotal role. Together, the informatics and the AI are structured to really reinforce and help each other. Would you agree?
100%. I mean, I think that, you know, again, we're just going to break it down in simplistic terms and say it's the science of information, data analysis. That's the foundational building block of AI. So AI really has four components to it. Machine learning, which is data pattern recognition. Natural language processing, which is like your Siri on your phone or your Google or Alexa. And then reasoning and planning. So the first two, machine learning, is really simple. We use it all the time. You go on Amazon, you search for something, you get other suggested things to buy. So in a market basket analysis, Amazon is looking at that pattern recognition of what things people buy together. Again, seen it for many years. Natural language processing, all of us have some sort of smartphone and we'll talk to it. Hey, remind me that I got the podcast at 10 a.m. Phoenix Pacific Standard Time tomorrow. So you naturally talk to a computer, but for some sort of specific task. The reasoning and planning is still not always in full swing, but definitely the data component is the foundation of how AI will work.
Yeah, it's data hungry. This kind of reminds me of a story that we tell sometimes in the classroom, and it's told very nicely. And it goes like this, Ahmed. Three fish are swimming along in the water. And a big fish comes by and says, "Hey, how's the water?" And the other fish look up and they go, "What's water?" They're not aware of this thing called water. And, you know, we use that to teach people to be aware of their emotional intelligence and the people around them. But it's kind of like AI, you know, like you mentioned, we see AI everywhere and maybe without realizing its presence. Like you said, with Netflix and Amazon, Siri, Alexa, even Tesla. I mean, we're using this stuff all the time and we may not even be aware of it. But most recently, though, it is in the news everywhere all the time. Do you sense that in the healthcare space? Is there this acute awareness that everybody's talking about it? It's a buzz for everybody, or is it still kind of down in the noise there? What's your perception? Because you're out there in it.
Yeah, I'm in it. I would tell you 2024 is a year of caution. I've said it before. Everyone thinks AI is all around. The news, I think, has definitely caused a little bit of hesitancy and lack of adoption and way more caution. Oh my God, where's our data going? What's the processing? What's the privacy issues? Who's housing it? We don't want this data to get into the wrong hands. We're in a state of caution right now. And I think the news has played into that. And I do my best to educate that AI is these four components, and some parts of AI can be used without a full bore AI. You don't need to have machine learning, natural language processing, and reasoning and planning on everything you adopt. Right. As you see with Amazon, we're good with just machine learning. As you see with your cell phone, you're good with just natural language processing. How you want that data to be processed, reasoned, and help make decisions with planning, we need more standards. And I've been to a couple big conferences this year, and it's just time and time again, nobody knows what to do with it right now. In fact, I had a call earlier this morning, no joke, with a big health system enterprise chief medical informatics officer who told me that our executive leadership is not certain what to do. And this is the norm across the country as of 2024 right now. We're just not sure. We're nervous. But here's what I have to say. Spotify, you know, the music app. And if it curates some music for you based off your likes that you like, and it's just keep flowing and playing this music and you're vibing and have a good time, is that a bad thing? In my opinion, it's not. I love having the right song at the right time, at the right moment, based off of music that I like. So that is some elements of AI looking at what I listen to and prompting that ahead of time. So healthcare is no different. If we can leverage genomic data, pharmacogenomic data, lab data, med data, looking at outcomes from other people that look exactly like you from a data perspective and start to predict in 5 years, you'll be here. In 2 years, you'll be there. It gives you, as a consumer of healthcare, power to make decisions early. Now, sometimes you might not want to make any decision, and I've seen that, and that's okay. We're human. Decision-making for our own selves and health is very complicated. I will admit that firsthand. That's why we're always taught in medicine, things are shared decision-making. But if I can give you data and information that an AI engine helped to curate a beautiful song for you to make you feel good, or give you information that you and your doctor can make a better decision that, hey, the way that this lesion looks totally benign. We really don't need to put a needle in you and cause bleeding and land in the hospital and deflate your lung and put a chest tube until we get to this point, because the AI told us at this point is when we got a biopsy. So I just gave you 9 months of delay that is beneficial delay. We don't have to jump and stick needles and biopsy everything all the time. But as doctors, we're taught, hey, I found this weird shadow, okay? And sometimes I like when families tell me, oh, doc, we want to delay because I'm an inpatient doctor. We want to talk to our outpatient doc. This happened to me the last weekend I covered. And I loved that family member for that. And I said, I want to say that that was probably the right decision because this is just something that landed in my hand. I haven't even really processed this with comparison. Let's delay the decision on what to do. And AI can help circumstances like this. You got a wedding to go to in a week. Do you really need to go see the doctor or do something invasive before? No. AI has told us that this is unlikely to be that. So let's wait it out. These are the types of things we don't talk about, the good aspect of AI that can help us live our lives with less anxiety, not more. And I'm not saying that AI is foolproof and every circumstance is benign. Don't get me wrong. But we don't need to jump into the water every single time something prompts. And AI can help with these decisions beyond just imaging guidance, but comparing us to people with our exact similar genetic profile, racial profile, background, lab, everything. And now we can make better and better decisions, not just the docs and the clinicians, but the patients.
You know, there's a lot of diversity on the whole subject of AI. And I was motivated recently because I had this curiosity that I need to satisfy. So I signed up for a 7-week course at MIT on AI in healthcare. And they really did a pretty good job, I think, of trying to level set awareness, what this thing is all about and some of the concerns with it. And I think the most important thing that I took out of that course was ask yourself the question, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to solve? And can you use AI to solve this problem in a way which is beneficial? And they talked at times about some superhuman events, things that you just can't do as a person by yourself or as a group of people. And they went over some examples of that. And I couldn't hardly believe it, but they stated this to be true, and I don't doubt it. But they took in millions and millions of samples of people coughing with three different levels of coughing. A cough which was, and another one which was like that. Three different samples. But they had millions of these, and they could run this through an AI model, and they could determine if that person had COVID, was going to have COVID, or didn't have COVID. They proved this, they said, with a very high degree of accuracy. Yes. And I thought, that's superhuman. I mean, how in the world could you ever figure something out like that? Now, not everything out there is going to be superhuman, but there are opportunities for things like that to happen, I'm sure. Have you seen or experienced some AI-type solutions that you go, wow, this is really interesting?
Yeah. First off, I'm going to tell you that everything you just said, I believe it to be 100% true, that if you look at enough data points of a simple cough, then absolutely you can predict which one will head where, whether it's a lung disease or a COVID. I absolutely believe that. I've even listened to presentations where these AI machines could tell your sex, whether you're male or female, based off your EKG tracing.
Wow.
It's like, wait a minute. Are you sure? But that's what they found. So answer your question directly, however, have I seen this used in healthcare? Not yet. I think that this is very advanced. It's hard to digest for some. We're seeing the beginnings of it in imaging applications. So a number of years ago, I was at another conference and the chairman of board of Alphabet, which was Google's parent company, talked about how their computer vision engine has looked at millions upon millions of, eye images, fundoscopic images. And so the very best surgeon in the universe has only seen a few thousand, for example. I'm not quoting exactly, but if you've looked at million and millions of images, the smallest of the small lesion, you can tell which will become a disease and which will not. So this type of use of AI in tech has actually been talked about for a while. And we're seeing other applications with colonoscopies. As you move a colonoscope through a colon, you could see, oh, a green, that's probably a benign lesion, or red, that might need to be biopsied. But other than these applications, it's really not quite yet in the mainstream, these bizarre phenomenon, like a little cough and concluding something, or an EKG tracing, and without looking at the person's name or what the sex is written on it, predicting which it is. Some of these applications are really probably not that helpful clinically. Some might be. So it's hard to know. And sometimes the data is really not necessary to take action. So I talked to, I used to do some advisory work for a major multi-billion-dollar corp. And they were telling me how they think they can predict prostate cancer in men in their 20s. And they asked what I thought about it. And unfortunate or unfortunate, I just started laughing. And I said, no man in their 20s is going to let you get invasive anywhere near their prostate and accidentally nick the wrong nerve, and then they're not going to be able to use the bathroom correctly. So there are still risks with taking action on data and information too early. And let me ask you, do you check the address to get to somewhere you're going to go to in 3 days from now? Probably not. You might to get a, oh, this is a 30 minute, but until that moment you're going to embark on your journey, that's the time you need that data to decide which route. Yes. So some of these very early, as you called it, superhuman predictability, it's really not ready for mainstream yet. And I think me taking off my informatics hat, putting on a pure clinician hat, I don't know what I would do with that yet. Because, okay, your cough is COVID, but I can't just admit you to the hospital and start you on some, you know, treatment yet because you are not hypoxic yet or you haven't met the criteria. So now we have this discordance between evidence-based guideline and very, very early, you know, use. So if you're not sick yet, I'm not going to take action yet. And oh, by the way, your immune system might kick it all off to the side and you never might get sick anyway. But maybe the future models will predict that too. So who knows? Maybe at first cough in 10 years from now, we just get you to the hospital, dump you down with, drench you with all these fluids and meds and send you on your way before you show a sign of symptom. We could get there. Why not? But we are definitely not there today.
Well, you know, Ahmed, some statistics here. Medical knowledge, they say, doubles every 50 years back in 1950. Yeah. And in 1980, medical knowledge doubled in 7 years. And in 2010, medical knowledge doubled in 3.5 years. And now it doubles in months. Medical yeah. knowledge doubles in months. I call that infotoxology. So much information, it's toxic, okay? And how in the world can a physician or anybody who's a medical professional keep up with all this change? So I just think there's an area there where healthcare data that's going through this exponential growth can be organized better with some of these AI tools.
Yeah.
I mean, because it is a bit overwhelming. Recently, one of our physician students sent me a book, and the book's called Artificial Intelligence in Healthcare. It's by Dr. Parag Mahajan. And in it, he goes over FDA approvals starting in 2017, and he lists out companies. And there's probably about 50 or 60 companies that have products that are in the areas, all AI approved for cardiology, radiology, psychiatry, endocrinology, geriatrics, neurology, emergency yeah. medicine, ophthalmology. It goes on. And I'm going, these things, and it has nice little stories in there. So I'm starting to look at that and say, wow, these are approved by the FDA and they're starting to be used and they're having good results with it. And at the same time, there's risk and uncertainty and things of that nature associated with them.
Yeah, so I'm going to take this moment to give a plug to myself and all of my colleagues in clinical informatics. We are the translators of that for you. So let's just flip the script for a second. Oncology meds change all the time. I'm not an oncologist. So as soon as I find out someone has a certain diagnosis, I consult and send them off to oncology. Clinical informatics physicians are your translators of what's worthwhile, what is worth pursuing for use for clinical care. So the early cough detection tool, let's just arbitrarily call it that, is not ready for pulmonologists yet. And it's my job to kind of help determine when things are ready and translate all this information. And I love that infotoxicity.
Infotoxology.
Infotoxology.
Yeah, use that.
That's such a good word because that's what it is. But I always prided myself in avoiding bombarding the clinicians. In fact, I would rarely go to them because that way, when I went to the clinician, they knew that this was real and ready for mainstream. We as informatics clinicians have to, you know, get rid of the noise and look what's ready and what's worthwhile to pursue and what's going to make a clinical impact for the patients. Some things are obvious, some things are not.
So Ahmed, you recently have been appointed as a board member to the Health Standards Institute. Congratulations
yes,
on that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Tell me more about that, and let's talk about standards in general. Are these things yeah. starting to evolve? What's your insight yeah. on that?
So if it's okay, I'm going to just give you a quick definition of what standards are. My wife is a clinician, and when I got appointed to this board, which is a phenomenal honor, I'm very grateful, and I'll talk more about it in a moment. she kind of asked me, what is standards? So in simplistic terms, standards is something we all agree upon to use universally. And my favorite example is how Apple is forced to use USB-C outlet plugs to charge phones instead of the old lightning components. We have a global universal standard of what we're going to use to charge our cell phones, okay? So that's really it. A standard is a rule, or it could be a material item like a charging cable, something by which is set that we're all going to follow, we all agree upon. And that's very difficult to get there, because all of us to agree on something is very, very difficult.
Yes.
But if Apple could be convinced that you have to use a USB-C, then by golly, we could create standards for other things as well. So as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, there's really a huge gaping hole in standards for healthcare with regards to AI. And so we're tasked with this big standard creation of creating this set of rules by which others will follow. Now, it's not meant to be totalitarian. Standards are a guideline. So if you want to go produce another cell phone with a different type of plug than a USB-C, nobody is stopping that. But if we create this equitable standard by which everybody now knows which AI is real AI, how it can be used, what's safe, we can start to get past this phase we're in of caution. And we can get into the implementation phase of using super advanced technology that we already discussed, how it can help me as a clinician and me as a patient, because we all live that component. So by creating these standards, we know how AI can be used, what constitutes AI, how to implement AI, and how it's going to help and be safe, and so on and so forth. And now everybody can take a sigh of relief and understand that we're all going to follow this standard. And that way, AI can be used safely and we can trust it more in certain applications.
That's a noble cause you're on there. There's no doubt about that. So I'm looking forward to learning more about that and seeing how that starts to evolve. Final questions here. You've been working with executive physicians and you've been educating them on informatics and AI. Are the doctors ready for change?
My short answer is yes. Because over the last few years, not just with ChatGPT, but little minute things using AI has made certain aspects of our life better, more predictable, and more accurate. And it has really helped with decision making. So I'm going to come back to Maps and Spotify. And I have no conflicts, by the way, with Spotify. I just think it's cool that the next song that comes up, I didn't select. It was selected for me, but I still enjoyed it. If you don't think that that's a bad thing, I think you're ready for AI. If you think this is bad, why are you telling me what song to listen to? Then you're probably not ready. And, you know, medicine and in general is notorious for, you know, let's just say not wanting to adopt technology. But I laugh. I'm not that old. I'm in my 40s, to be honest. But I was handwriting notes in 2009 and part of 2010. No new clinician that I have met training in medicine is writing their notes. They're all typing and using a computer. But typewriters have been out since God knows when. So the new generation, the new crop is definitely ready. And the older generation that's ahead of me, I think, is also accepting more. We are ready now, but what we're missing are standards and buy-in from executive leadership because of the caution. It's time to get past the caution. See the greater good, have the standards set so that we all feel safe and know that if I have a USB-C cord, I can charge my phone, whether it's an Apple product or an Android or whatever, because we follow a standard.
Well, I can tell you this. I think you and I both agree that it's never going to be the same. It's never That's going to sure. be the same. Things are changing. This has been an incredible discussion hour. With Dr. Ahmed Abizazegan. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for all that you're doing to help educate us and get us aligned with this ever-changing world of informatics and artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you again soon in Dallas. And I thank you for thinking of me. It was absolutely fun.